All right, this is Leo Bustin, and today we're discussing, do animals grieve? And I guess I could say yes and then leave. I want to hear about your animals, but first I'm going to tell you about some of these things. I should tell you that there's a great deal of interest in this now. I have been pushing it from the standpoint for many reasons, not the least of which is in experimentation. If you have animals, long-term animals, and they become attached to a given animal tenant, it can really mess up your results if you change the tenants or if one of the mates of one of these animals die. So one has to be cognizant of that. And I'll just go into a few of these things with you, and then we'll open it up for discussion. There was a large meeting at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons in cooperation with the Society of Thanatology, which is the Society of Studying Dead, and with the Animal Medical Center, which is one of the leading animal medical centers in the world, in New York. And they had a meeting about March 27th to 29th, 1981. And Linda Hines gave a talk there on the relief and prevention of grief in animals, and many other people did. It's being published, I think, by Iowa State Press. And on December 14th of this year, they're having another conference on grief in animals and handling it. And I tell you this, and some of you may sort of laugh about it, but we know now that the majority of people who own animals, when questioned, regard their animals as a member of the family. And when you ask them which member, most of them will say it's a child. And to many people, especially those who live alone, and especially older people, it's a very grievous thing when they lose their animal. In fact, some of them have been known to take their own life. And so it's important that we address this issue. Not long ago, there was a newspaper headline which read, "Without Sparky, Mistress Dies." And Sparky was a dog. And this was reported in the Daily Gate City a newspaper. And the article went on to state that there was this 77-year-old woman died of what her friends insist was a broken heart. She was in a housing, I suppose it was public housing, and they decided to enforce a no-pet regulation that they had. It was for senior housing. And they said you had to either give up your animal or find other housing, and she couldn't find other housing, so she had to give up her animal. And she didn't live very long after that. And she stopped taking daily walks, refused to bathe, and almost stopped eating. Now you say, well, this is just some kook old lady, but I can give it to you many times over. So we have to start taking these things seriously. And a lot of you say, well, boy, that poor old woman. Well, I feel very sorry for that lady, but I also feel sorry for the dog, because the dogs really also suffer on these circumstances. I think our dog probably suffers every time the chief leaves Dingbat in the room. Dingbat is a dog, she calls her Bridget, it's a hearing dog. They're together most of the time. But when she leaves her, I imagine that dog is very concerned about this. At least she's concerned for at home for a few minutes until she's sure that she's out of the driveway, and then she probably goes up on the bed. I have another letter here. This is from a lady in Spokane. She'd seen us on television or something. She says, "It was a sad day for me when Topsy, too, had to leave me. She had lived a long and happy life. For 12 years in the dog's life is calculated to be the same as over 80 in humans." Well, it depends on the dog. She had enriched the lives of all who knew and loved her, and had given back that love in double portion. What the world would have missed what would have missed if Mother and I hadn't been guided that day to take an unfamiliar road back home, and her little life had been snuffed out because she was a female and nobody wanted her. How I missed her for a long, long time. And my eyes would often fill with tears when I would come home from town and there was no little dog to come bounding up to the door to her and welcome home with a welcome home bark. Now, many years later, as I look back over my long life filled with many blessings, I count among these blessings as one of God's sweetest gifts to me, the love of a little dog. So these older people really regard this, these animals, and I've seen a lot of them, and as I told some of you in another session, I have seen a lot of people in nursing homes who are there in pathologic grief years after they have been parted from their animal. Now, on grieving animals, I guess one of the I'll lead up to some of these, one of the more remarkable ones, I was the oldest person that ever took the Aquavet course at Woods Hole, which is one of the leading marine biological laboratories in the world, Cape Cod. I did this about 3 years ago, and there's only 30 or 31 in the class, and it's a concentrated class for a month. You sort of go to school night and day. It's mainly for young veterinarian students. And my partner, well, when you get old, you also get wiser, and so you pick somebody as a lab partner that you know knows a lot more about it than you do. And so I had biographies of all the students. We all had submitted biographies. So I picked Pat because she had taught aquatic and marine biology in Canadian universities, and she had. In later life, well, I suppose she was in her 30s, she got into a veterinary school. So she was my lab partner, and she told me that some years earlier, she met a fellow who had two pet gerbils. They're kind of a small Mongolian rodent. And these were his pets. And she married him in a way. And she became quite attached to these gerbils, like very attached to them, and they'd let these gerbils out to play periodically, and then they'd have to say, well, we've time to get the gerbils in, but they quit doing that because the gerbils caught on to this and they'd go and hide, so they had to use signals. But one day, now this, I think they were about 5 years old and they were married, and I think 3 years or so, 3.5 years later, one night when they had him out, she went to the refrigerator to get something out, and the more curious one of the two male gerbils jumped up on the ledge of the refrigerator, and she didn't see it, and she closed the refrigerator door on the gerbil and killed it, and she felt pretty badly about it, and the other gerbil refused feed and died in less than 3 days. Now you can say, well, maybe that wasn't grief. I don't know. Lorenz, Conrad Lorenz, who I mentioned before, and who we honored on his 80th birthday in Vienna just a few months ago, and who shared the Nobel Prize on his studies in animal behavior. It's probably his most famous book is King Solomon's Ring. It's a fun book. But he spent a lot of his life on geese and fish, and he told about geese and observed the gray-like geese a lot. And when they lose a mate, they really get distressed and go through a lot of the stages of grief that you see in people. They become anxious and restless. They'll fly around looking for the animal at greater and greater distances. Sometimes they get lost in the process and die. But it's really sad to watch them, and they call. It's a mournful kind of a call. Others, people have described this in jackdaws, domestic dogs, orangutans, and chimpanzees. And I'll leave. I'll discuss the three famous dogs with you. The first one is Old Shep. If you ever go through Fort Benton, Montana, you'll see on the railroad, if they still go there, I don't know, there's a statue out there to Old Shep. And the story on Old Shep is that, and this happened in about late 30s, this sheep herder got old Shep as to help him herd his sheep. And he's a very good dog, and they had a close association. Well, the old sheep herder died, and so they took his body into Fort Benton and put it on a train, and the dog accompanied them, and since he could get on the train, he set up residence under the decking of the railroad station. And for the next 5.5 years, he met every train that came into Fort Benton and checked everybody that came off. And one night, in the middle of winter, he slipped, or else committed suicide, I don't know, but he slipped and went under the train and got killed. The second one I want to talk about is Corky, who was a fox terrier. His mistress was a 14-year-old girl named Angela, who attended a school called Our Lady of the Angels School. Some of you may know it in South, I think it's Los Angeles. And they had a tragic fire there, and it burned up, among other people, Angela. Now the dog would sometimes go with her to school. And 3 times the dog got away and went to the school, and they found the dog sitting in front of the charred remains of the school. And they finally got the dog back and locked it in the house. And it just went under Angeline's bed and stayed there for 3.5 days and refused to feed. And finally they got it to recover. And sometimes a veterinarian will have these turned into them where they have to actually give them intravenous therapy because they refuse, some of them refuse feed. Or if you have a long-term association with two animals, with one dying, you may have to, the other one may refuse feed. I'll give you a very divert from my third dog here. Recently, I had my attention called to a horse that would have been had a long association with a sheep. They were in the same pasture for years. And one day, the horse died, and they removed him, and the sheep went into the horse's stall and stayed there, refused feed, and died within a few days. The third dog that I'm going to tell you about is probably the most celebrated dog in Japan. His name is Hachi. Hachi was, his master was a professor at the university, and every day that he'd go to the university, the dog would accompany him to the railroad station. See him off on the train, and he'd meet him there at night. And one day the professor didn't come home because he died. But this dog kept going to the railroad station each day, even though the family moved to another location. He still kept going to the station, and he continued his daily sojourns to the station until he died 10 years later. Now they established a memorial in this railroad station before the war, and they melted it down during the war, and then re-poured it and established it after the war. And a lot of in that area, if you're going to meet somebody, you always say, "Well, I'll meet you at Hachi," you know, at the statue for Hachi. So it's a very famous one. Well, the take-home lesson that I tell you these stories is that they become very attached to these people, are very loyal and faithful, but they're also, I think, grieving because they manifest some of the same behavior as people do. But the other thing that I tell it to you for is we shouldn't let them do that. In the case of the shepherd's dog, what they should have done is to got him another good sheep herder, you know, and say, "Here's a real good dog for you," instead of having going through this fruitless search, meeting every train for 5.5 years. Mm-hmm. That's a terrible thing to have a dog do. Or in the case of this professor's dog, you know, they should have found another professor. Wanted to be met every night and taken to the station. That'd been great. I wish I had a dog that'd do that. especially pull my bicycle up those hills in Pullman at night. Our dog would do it if we had squirrels along the way. That's the only thing, the redeeming feature of our dog here. Our dog is a completely different animal here, our hearing dog, with these crazy squirrels. She's an ordinary, very friendly dog, but all she's got on her name, on her mind, are squirrels and chipmunks. Chief says the only advantage of it, if she's going up to the portal, the dog pulls her up the hill. Comes back all too poop to pant. Now, I want to go into some of the other animals and some of their manifestations. Well, you know, sheep aren't really that smart, but if you've seen them, you take away their lamb when they die. Boy, they'll go searching all over the place, get really excited and nervous about the whole thing. And one species will become attached to another. We had a very expensive foal that was brought to our clinic at Washington State University, and it wasn't doing well at all. The mother had rejected it. And usually one of our students has a herd of goats, seems like all the time. And one of the students brought in a milking goat for this little foal, young filly, and she attached him. It was kind of a comical looking affair, you know. This horse, this foal would be laying there, and in fact one day I watched him and kind of woke up and the goat was started standing over him, so he just took one of the nozzles laying there and so he was nursing this goat. And when they take him out for an examination, that old goat would cry like crazy, you know. Filly was gone. So you see this kind of attachment for them. And you'll see sheep bleeding around, racing around, and aimless searching. So it's really kind of sad to watch. Now, a lot of people said, well, pigs certainly don't grieve. Well, I'll give you two cases of those. A friend of mine in Olympia, he's trying to teach me how to fish salmon. And so I go and get a lesson about once a year. He's a retired veterinarian, and he has a son who's one of his sons flying fly for United Airlines, and they have a farm out to Enumclaw, and they have some pigs. They bought, I think, five or six pigs, little ones, and they became very attached to them. And when they got up to be about slaughter size, they had a butcher come in to take four of them off and left two. And when this fellow and his kids went down to feed him the next day, these two remaining, they sat in the back of the pen and wouldn't even come out. They kind of looked at him, you know, like, what'd you do with my buddies, you know? And this went on for, I guess, a couple of days. The other one, a very interesting one, it's at University of North Carolina, where our son took some of his training. They have some interesting colonies of pigs there because they're interested in hemophilias. And they have several animals that are hemophilic. They brought in a herd from Missouri who had one form of hemophilia. So they had female hemophilia carriers and hemophilic also, those suffering from hemophilia. And they had them in this pen for a long time, so they were closely associated. And one day they took the carriers out and left this one hemophilic pig. And he just went berserk. And he went tearing, he jumped through, went over two or three fences into other pens looking for these other pigs. And this went on. He couldn't settle him down for, I guess, a couple of days. In fact, the only way they could settle him down, eventually, I think after the third day, they brought him into a bunch of sows in heat. And then he sort of forgot about it. but it obviously was showing manifestations of what I call grief. One of the more interesting people I've read is a guy named Eugene Murray. He's educated in law and medicine at the time of the Boer War, and he got mad at the English. He was in South Africa, and he only published in Afrikaans. And and two of his books were translated. And one of them was The Soul of the White Ant, the other was Life of the Baboon or something. Since that time, I don't know if you remember Robert Ardrey, African Genesis, you know. Well, I talked to Robert Ardrey about this because I wanted him to do, he's a playwright, you see. Robert Ardrey's a playwright, and I thought he should have done a movie on Eugene Marais, because he was anti-establishment. And he was a conservationist. He was also in the drug culture. I think that's what probably did him in. But he made a lot of interesting observations. But Ardrey said, he claimed he found another manuscript of his. In fact, was published as a third book not long before Ardrey finally drank himself. Well, no, when Ardrey died. But in this book on the life of the baboons, what he did was to follow this troop of baboons, and he made observations on them for over quite a period of time. Very interesting observations. In fact, for a while this troop of baboons adopted a goat as a pet, and he set up his headquarters, his little shack, next to their sleeping quarters, where he was never allowed by the baboons. But he made these observations on him. But one night he was awakened by very distraught leaders of the baboon troop, and he accompanied them to the sleeping quarters. They came and woke him up in the middle of the night, and he went with them with a lantern. And he noted this very strange behavior, but he couldn't see, you know, anything that was wrong, so he went back to bed. But he's awakened early the next morning by what he called the sound of lamentation, and then he discovered a number of infants that had died during the night and were outside. And he says there was great consternation and acute grief was evident in the troop. In his words, he said, "What we heard was the terrible, blood-freezing cry of the wolf from the baboons, persistent and heart-rending. It is almost impossible to exaggerate the effect of this sound on the human being. On most occasions, it sounded to our ears more moving than even the cry of mourning of human beings, just because the lamentation of the baboons is wordless. It is a purely emotional sound, more or less similar to the inarticulate groaning and sighing by which the deepest anguish of the human heart finds speechless expression." And then Murray went on to describe how one of the grieving young mothers followed him, emitting begging sounds. She wanted exactly what the seven large males who had visited us unexpectedly the previous evening had wanted: our help to ward off the approaching death for the infants, that approaching death of which in all probability they had become aware of the previous evening. And the mother wanted for us the revival of her child. She wanted to have changed that huge and remorseful condition which in her environment she had learned to know as death. And there are other examples of this. In fact, there's a book out on many years ago. In fact, in 1879, a fellow named Brown wrote Grief and Chimpanzees. I had personal experience with this during my time at the University of California, when I was directing a laboratory, a cancer laboratory. We discovered my associates discovered a virus in the gibbon, which is it's an ape. It's a white-handed gibbon. And this was proved to be a very interesting finding. And so we assembled a group of gibbons, and we got a pair, and the National Cancer Institute was very interested to make get some studies on the offspring. But the offspring died, and you should have heard, I used to be able to imitate this. I don't know if you've heard gibbons call, but it's an unusual calling. Hoo, 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 hoo. And and it's a very, it's a rather complicated call. And about this time, when she was in mourning, we had a wife of a State Department official who was visiting back in the States, and she had heard about our Gibbons, so she came up to visit them because she had great interest in Gibbons. In fact, she probably had some pets because they're a very popular pet in Southeast Asia. And her husband was in Thailand. And as she was taken towards, walking towards the house where these Gibbons were maintained, she said, without having been told anything about this, she said, one of your Gibbons is in mourning. And she was right, because she'd lost her child. So so we see these kind of things. Now, I am, of course, interested in the relief of this, from some of this grief. I am trying to school our associates and our students to have regard for this and to do some of the things I've already told you about, and to help not only recognize the grief in people and deal with it, but also in animals. Now, with people, we are recommending more and more that you have, when somebody asks me to get, they should get a cat or a dog or something else, I tell them, especially if they're old or if they're gone a lot, to get two animals. I don't know if you read Dr. White's All Creatures Great and Small,
Harriet.
His alias is Harriet. He described that a moving thing on this in one of his books, where this fellow who lived alone with this dog, and he'd go to the pub every night, and the dog would go with him. And one day he was worried about his dog, so he took it to see Harriet. And Harriet says, "Well, it's got cancer." And he says, "There isn't much hope for it." And the guy seemed very cavalier about this. And so he just says, "Well, I guess we better put it to sleep." So he just did it in right there. And the fellow went home, see the empty bed and the empty dog dish, and shot himself. I mean, he took his own life. So after that, he was more careful on how he dealt with this. So that's I think, very important. We'll be going through, you've already heard some of the stages of grief already, from, if you attended the sessions of Dr. Pastor Granger Westberg, and he goes through the various stages. You can't necessarily recommend all of these, but you can recognize some of them in the animals that I've seen. I think of horses, where a horse might do well in one association for a long time, and you put him with another owner, and things go to pot. So they become very, very attached, to certain, not only to other animals, but also to certain masters. Now, one of the things that we're trying to do about this, not only is selection of the animals properly, but we also are promoting legislation to permit animals in certain nursing homes. We have now worked to get a bill through legislature, well, through Congress, that permits animals in government housing. And we're helping now write the, we're writing up the guidelines. Hopefully they'll accept some of them. We're also working in various states to have them promote legislation to permit animals in nursing homes, convalescent homes. The legislation passed, incidentally, Senator Lee in this state pushed it through here. It's in Minnesota. It's in California. So more and more states, and they got it through, a friend of mine got it through in Arizona. So we have that, and moving towards that, so you're not going to have this kind of separation which affects both the animal and the person. The other thing we're doing, and we're just starting it in our place, you have a grief, what do they call it? When they have people get together who have lost...
Wake?
No, the organization you have. You know, he mentioned it in
support,
here today.
Support group.
Yeah, it's a support group.
Children.
Well, anyway, we're looking at that for animals. In fact, we've just gone through that. Because the loss of animals is far more frequent than the loss of people. And my associates recently, my close associate, in fact, the lady that trained, very fond of Chief and trained Dingbat, or Bridget, to be a hearing dog, she just lost her second German Shepherd. I mean, she was in deep grief. And some of you saw my picture of Spook, the cat that was sitting on the John, trained to sit on the John. Well, Spook died at 4 and a half. So, and he died first. So I got those two together. I had Terry go and talk to Marie, and it was very helpful to her. And of course, I've lost a lot of animals, so I had a session with her. But it's very important that we recognize this. One of the worst things you can ever tell a person, you know, that's really feeling shook up about this, is it was just an animal. Huh? Well, every time I hear that, I feel like clubbing them over the head. That's terrible. Because to them, it's just like a child, whether you say they're crazy or whatever, but it's a very serious matter. So we're working on that, and I think it's very important in our situation today. Now, what I'd like to do is open it up, because I'd like to hear some of your stories, because I'm sure some of you probably made more observations than that, and then I'll tell you maybe I'll tell you a few more stories, and then we'll close it off. Yes.
There's a friend of mine that was telling a story about a friend of hers who had a cat was out on the front porch, and there was this chipmunk that would just kind of run around and playfully, you know, and they had a rapport and bonding between this chipmunk and the cat. And the cat had a favorite place in the bedroom, you know, like with all these pillows and stuff that would lay there all the time when it was in the house. And the cat died one day, and later on, this woman was in the bedroom cleaning or something, and here she discovered the chipmunk laying in the spot where the cat always laid, somehow gotten into the house, you know, through an open door, and was aware of that spot, you know, and my friend was telling me that was just incredible, you know.
Yeah, it's a wild animal.
Yeah. Yeah, and there it was, laying in the bed, right, where the, you know, curled up where the cat did, right by the door.
Yeah, because ordinarily, cats eat chipmunks.
Yeah, and you know, that was the kind of thing the cat would watch, and the chipmunk would play around
it. Very interesting.
Yeah.
There was a hand back there. Yes.
With the greeting of the owner, but I'm a LCA pastor from Illinois, and I have a friend who is also a pastor who told me that he was approached by a member of his congregation to have a graveside service for a cat.
Yeah.
And he did it because of his concern for the grieving of the woman. It was very real.
I'm glad you brought that up, because closure is very important. And we've just gone through that. I recommended to this lady that lost Spook, the 4 and a half year old cat, that she have, but that she bury it in a favorite place, which she did. And I also recommend that. I had a terrible call about a month ago, from months and a half now, from Becky, our daughter. And I couldn't even, she was sobbing
and I thought she was dying, and having lost a daughter within the last year, I couldn't stand to lose another one, and it really shook me up. I finally got her quieted down, and she finally figured out that it was her cat, who I called Dizzy Liz, who was now about 14 years old, was very ill. In fact, the way she described it, I knew it wasn't going to live very long. And this was a very, very grievous thing, because the cat belonged to our daughter who died, and she had taken it over when our Karin left 2 years before for the Cameroon. And she was sobbing and saying, you know, at first it's Karin and now it's her cat, which was her cat now, and she was very attached to it. So this was a very, very grievous thing. And when the cat died, then she called me up again, and I recommended that she put it where I thought that Karin would have put it, near their rented house by a tree. And this closure, I think, is very important. And as Boris Levinson has pointed out, this is very good experience for any of you who have children, that when the animal dies, that if it's permitted within your town, that you do have a, shall I talk a little louder, that you have a burial service. We did that when our children were young for all of our pets, and I think it was very important, and it sort of teaches them how to deal with this. So I'm very grateful to you that you brought this up. We mustn't make diminish the importance of this. And as you'll find out tonight, in fact, tonight's going to be a very interesting night for us. I'm sorry that we don't have the full time to do it, but and you'll get hear more about it. But I'll tell you a little bit about it now. I have appeared on national international conferences with a dear friend named Jim Harris. Dr. Harris is in practice in Oakland, California, and he's a somewhat unusual in because a lot of people send him their nuts, people that are different, because he is very compassionate, and he keeps very close track of the people. A lot of people, as I mentioned the other day, deal only with disease. That's one of our problems in the health delivery system today. We deal with a disease instead of the patient and the client or whatever it might be. He deals with the whole situation, and we've been on several conferences where we talk about grief and dealing with this. And he has a friend who's a Episcopal cleric, and he said, you know, you ought to write a service for this, you see. And I was at I was down at for a meeting. We were going to present a symposium at the American Association of Advancement of Science here a few weeks ago down in San Francisco. So the day before, we went out to his home at Inverness, out of Point Reyes, and had a meeting, and he invited some friends over for broiled oysters in the shell that evening, and which included this vicar, who he had asked for this ceremony, and he wrote this thing out for him, and gave it to him on his 50th birthday. I have a copy of it, and tonight is the first time in history that this will be done, except in shortened form, because we are not having a burial service, but I hope you like it. It's a very interesting liturgy, and they seem to think, the theologians seem to think, it has some that it is substantial. And if you've been here for the last couple of days and heard Dan talk about Ephesians, or if you heard what I discussed about the animals in the Judeo-Christian ethic, you'll realize that
that the covenant is with all creatures, and that God has great concern for all creatures. And so it is appropriate that we do that. Any other points that you want to bring up?
Yes. Annual battle with the starling, and he just boarded up a couple nests that these starlings had, and you know, the babies were still alive inside. And for days, the rest of the time I was there, the parents of the nestlings would be flying around, and it was just kind of heartrending because you could see it. I mean, there was no question that they were upset. And you know, starlings normally have a kind of an unpleasant sound, that sort of they just started breaking out into this brilliant song. I've never heard a starling do over and over and over. Long time. 4 or 5 days.
There's got to be a better way in doing it. Yes.
My brother-in-law has a pet cemetery in Spokane, and and people from, you know, as far away as Yakima or various other places have had their pets flown over and so forth to be in the pet cemetery.
I mean, I think this can be overdone, but we must not diminish the significance of the closure.
Leo, are you familiar with the woman who raised apes on Cuba? Cuba. The great ape, the gorillas.
The only ones I know on Cuba are the things set up by Carpenter on the island of non-human primates, on an island off there.
Was it a woman?
No.
I read this some years ago, and I'm a little vague, but I do remember about the grief. Twice gorillas died in one certain portion of this compound, and although they had never been together and touched each other or anything, their cages were adjacent, and there was tremendous grieving on the part of the really remaining apes. But then she said that at the far end of the compound, ape died, and there was no grieving because they hadn't known her, they hadn't ever seen her or had anything to do with her.
Yeah, they probably, the ones nearest to them, they not only saw them, they probably had conversation of some sort, or hand signals.
Yeah.
So there was probably communication.
Uh-huh.
We're back on tape. Thank you, Bob. What's difficult? One of the very difficult things we face with older people, and you see it in hospices and all. I mentioned the other night, or the other day, about Dame Cicely Saunders, who's one of the great people on earth. And she started the St. Crispus Hospice in London, South London. And she has some animals in residence, but she also has pet visitation for patients. And she feels this is very important, and it really is important. And I don't know if it was that at the hospice or some other place. This lady, she realized she was terminal, and she had sort of said goodbye to all her family and was well on the way for her own closure, but she was still very distressed because she really hadn't seen her animal for a long time. And the animal, of course, was very disturbed too. So they arranged for a special bus, special vehicle. I think they went out, and she had closure with her dog. And after that, she was at peace. That's why that we are, a couple of us are working with the Prince and Princess of Wales Hospice in Glasgow, where they're developing plans, probably well on the way now. A veterinarian friend of mine, Mary Stewart, at Glasgow Veteran College, and I have consulted there on trying to arrange for a certain portion of the hospice to permit people to bring their animals with them when they come for terminal care. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. In fact, I was very heartened recently. One of the better known hospitals here in the Northwest is Swedish Hospital in Seattle. Very good hospital and they do a lot of good work there. And there was one fellow that was in there. He wasn't doing very well. I think he had bypass surgery or something. And he wasn't doing well at all. He was homesick for his dog. He lived alone with his dog. I suppose the dog was shook up too. They didn't mention that. But they actually permitted this dog to come in the hospital to see him. And we're going to see more and more of this, I think. It's ridiculous the way we're doing it now. There's no reason, for example, and I'll get you, why, when my wife has an attack, say, of many years, that her dog shouldn't accompany her to the hospital. This isn't a big deal, you know. You can set aside, we can mobilize in Pullman people that will walk the dog and look after it. So there are arrangements that we can make for this. I'll never forget, I consult one of the places to one of the large medical complexes in the Southwest. It's sort of been called sort of the Mayo of the Southwest. And it's a pretty distinguished board of people on there. Like Robert O. Anderson is the president of the board. He is chairman of the board for Atlantic Richfield. The vice chairman of the board is a financier of real estate, oil, and he's always impeccably dressed. And one time we had a meeting, and he knew my game. He knew what I was up to, and he says, "You know, Leo," he says, "one of the hospitals here, my mother is up there. I think she was 85 years old, and she kind of likes to see me. But what's critical is that I get her dog to her." So here's this guy, that's vice chairman of the board, mind you, always impeccably dressed, but he'd put on a great big overcoat, you see, and into this hospital, which he's by turn the board, he'd sneak this animal under his coat, you see, up to the floor to see his mother every day. That was the most important thing to her. And that's kind of ridiculous, isn't it, you know, when you start thinking about it. Why don't we just arrange that a certain number of wards or something have it fixed so the animals can be with them. Now, there are some animals you probably wouldn't take in there. Some
what
people have
pigs?
Some pretty crazy pets. Pardon?
What about pigs? They should be able to come, right?
Well, especially if they're well trained, that wouldn't have any problem with that at all. Kind of encouraging. I used to sneak, when I was in research for certain tests, this still goes on, I probably shouldn't tell you folks this. we'd cover up the animal on a cart and take it down to the hospital, you see, and do the tests down in the hospital, hoping that the animal wouldn't say anything on the trip. Or now, before we got our CAT scan at the veterinary college, we'd take certain animals up to a CAT scanner up in Spokane in the evening and take it to the hospital and so on. Especially in certain cancers, no. And they're usually very cooperative on this. Yes?
Yeah, we allow...
Or you and then Chuck, yeah.
In our psychiatric unit, we allow pets to come and visit, you know, people
that's
to bring
good.
Them in. And I brought in my dogs and my pet kittens, brought them in. And in fact, if we could get a consensus of all of our staff on our senior treatment program to have a pet, we could have a pet on the unit. But, you know, cats, there are more people that are allergic to those. And
yeah.
For a dog, we'd have to have a commitment on everybody's part to take care of it. Otherwise, you know, if somebody gets stuck cleaning up a mess on the night shift and they didn't want that dog anyway.
Yeah.
But that's something that I want to pursue a little bit.
Where
more.
Is this?
Yeah, in Minneapolis at Fairview Hospital.
Oh, Fairview.
Yeah. Also in Minnesota, you can have pets.
That's
in
right.
Nursing homes.
And they were the first state to mm-hmm. enact that legislation. And you have a SendShare program, it's very good. And Robert Anderson is the director of the SendShare program, which is on the human-animal bond, probably one of the pioneers on it. Just a minute, Chuck is, and then you.
Yeah, Did you have... How do you reconcile the two things that you've been involved in recently? One, research, and then this grief.
My intent and how I justify my research, of course, my research now has to do with trying to determine the best animal, the qualities of the right animal and the temperament to place with a certain person, you see, that kind of research. For research in which the animals, when you interrupt the animal's normal life pattern by either an early death, this has to be justified on the basis that good will come out of it, and that the animal will not have any undue suffering, and that it will have a peaceful death. And there's most of you here today probably would not be alive if there hadn't been a lot of experimental research done on animals. So, but we have not been as sensitive to this issue as we should have. There are people over here who don't even wear leather and refuse to eat any meat and feel that a mouse has just as much right to be here as you do. And there are people over on this side who say, animals, you can, after all, you're in charge and you can do anything you want with them. Well, I say a plague on both their houses, in a way, that I'm somewhere in here, so I get pot shots from both sides. So that's how I sort of look at it, and I try to also live this way. I have been an experimental animal on some experiments and felt that it was necessary to do this. So that's sort of where I'm coming from on it. Yes?
My question is how cognitive animals are of the effect or relationship they have with people. Or if sometimes these things are purely coincidental, or as I like to think, this is God's way of accomplishing good things. But in River Bluff Nursing Home in Rockford, Illinois, every spring, a male and female mallard duck fly in and nest in the flower bed in the courtyard. And you should hear, I was there one day when the birds flew in, and the word went through the nursing home, the ducks are here, and everybody just flocked, and they just, you know, and the ducks were perfectly at home.
Yeah.
Everybody was careful not to disturb them, but they came in. This was their choice. They weren't raised there or anything. Are animals cognizant of this type of thing? Maybe not in this case.
Well, it's a very difficult question. There's a recent book out on it, on the awareness of animals. I think that it varies a lot within species. You'll find, for example, I think ducks, ducks are really quite sensitive. I know some people with pet ducks, and they have a good deal of perception. In cats, you have a great difference among them. We have placed certain cats, for example, with terminally ill, who are very sensitive. I have a friend who is a practitioner, and he... They had a cat come in that was really in a real mess. I think it had been chewed up or something, and it didn't have a very good chance of life. So they wanted to see what they could do, but the expense got too much, and the owners couldn't afford it to really go through with it all. So they had to either kill it, but the staff in this hospital, along with the veterinarians, decided after that the animal deserved to have a chance, so they invested their time and effort into saving the cat, and it had become the clinic cat, sort of. And this cat, he maintains that it is sensitive to the person in the clinic that probably needs the cat. In other words, it's maybe they have an animal in that's terminal, or it's in for euthanasia, or some other reason, and the cat seems to go to that person, and he says he doesn't think that it's just chance. I was on a radio station in a series of talks I gave in Texas, in San Antonio, and I mentioned this, and there's a veterinarian down there that runs a weekly program. They were interviewing me, and I told him about this, and I asked him if he'd observed that, and we were on the air, and he said he'd seen it a number of times, but that isn't true for every cat necessarily, you see, just like people, you know. Some people are sensitive to the needs of others, and some are completely oblivious to them. And so I guess I've gotten, you know, in the old days, probably when I was younger, I'd poo-poo this. I'm not so ready to do it. They pick up on a lot of signals, and very perceptive, and it's very interesting to study them. I guess that's why animal behavior is so fascinating. Yes.
When you were talking about the importance of closure, I know, yeah, of a situation where a family had a collie that they had gotten when the children were little, and the collie was a pup, and the collie grew up with the kids, and the dog was not sick, it was simply growing old. And they were at their lake cabin, and the dog knew that she was going to die, must have, because she went to each member in the family and then died.
Yeah, there's quite a few records of them almost sensing this. And it's hard to explain, and it's hard to do the research on a test case. You see, you have so many in this group and so many in this group. Yes?
When you're sick and have a pet, they are often just very quiet and comforting. Even a frolicking dog or puppy will be very quiet and gentle while a member of the family is sick, it seems like.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I know several instances of this, and when I was in Australia, I had a very good example of this. This dog was in this household, but it was very fond of the closest to the grandfather. He became intensely ill, and the dog wouldn't leave his bed and bedroom. And in another case, the lady was ill and couldn't get around the house, and this dog, I think it was an Airedale or something, had a batch of pups downstairs, and each day she'd bring up a pup, carry it up and show it to this lady, and then bring it back down. So you tell me what's going on. Yes?
We had a cat when our boys were small, and he would go to the one who was sick or had a, yeah, cold and spend time with him.
Yeah.
But the boys were graded in age, so they went to bed at half hour intervals. And the cat would walk up the stairs with the first one, lie on the foot of the bed until he fell asleep. He would come down, walk up the steps with the second one, the same thing. And then if I happened to be home, if my wife and I were sitting in the living room and she'd be sitting by this lamp and I'd be in my chair over by this lamp, the cat would come and lay exactly in the middle of the floor between us as though he didn't want to have any partiality. And that was routine,
yeah,
absolutely routine.
Yeah.
An African man told me one time that he was in the bush and he saw this mother female elephant carrying this dead baby around in her trunk for 3 days before she finally dropped it.
Yeah, they refused to believe it. Yeah, the elephants are very sensitive on this. I,
I watched him on the Serengeti, and the and you know, the elephants, if you let them go, I mean, they can really tear up the, and you have to kind of control the population. Well, I think it was in the Belgian Congo. They'd go in periodically and shoot them. And the grieving was more than they could stand. And so what they then organized, they would get very high-powered rifles, and they would pick out family units and destroy the whole family unit almost immediately. You see what I mean? So that everybody was killed within a few minutes. They'd pick their targets and then let them have it. So they, because they couldn't stand the grieving. There are records, you know, of elephants finding bones from elephants and tusks and carrying them off.
Oh yes, I've seen them on television.
Yeah. So there is, and I had a story in here. I'll go into it where this. Well, maybe I will. Let's see. I think it's time, though. I think we're already over time. Yeah.
The bell might have rung.
Yeah. It's 5:15. I think it's kind of a barbecue tonight, and it's between 5:15 and 5:45. Thank you very much for your participation.